This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
So let me start with a story. This story involves two of Buddha's homies, his two friends, Sariputta and Moggallana. Okay? Now, the story happens in a time before these two cats met the Buddha. And as the story goes, these two dudes who are really good friends were hanging out at basically a party. You know, this is 2,500 year ago, party in India. And so it's probably a bonfire or something, and lots of people drinking and lots of people, you know, eating a lot and trying to get laid and all the sort of stuff that you do at parties. And these two guys were kind of, have you ever had the experience of kind of hanging out outside of something and just you have this kind of brief moment of, you know, just kind of objective, wow, this is really wild what's happening here. So most of the time you're in it, but you have this sort of, this is what they were experiencing, this sort of sense, maybe they're even standing off on like a hill on the side or something. And they were looking down at this party and just seeing all these people eating way too much and hitting on each other and smoking their hookahs or whatever. And they got the sense that it was sort of like, well, it's pleasurable and it's nice, but we've done it. And it doesn't actually bring, it's pleasurable, but it's not fulfillment. It isn't happiness. And you can live your whole life chasing pleasure, you know? And maybe that's fulfilling for some people, but for these two dudes, they were kind of hanging out, and they were having this nice shared experience of, yeah, there's got to be something more than just getting loaded and getting laid all the time, you know? Maybe there's something deeper experience to have in this life. And the two of them kind of made a pact that, and they were already kind of on this spiritual path, you know, but they were having this really beautiful moment together, and they made a pact, and they said, they didn't live in the same town, apparently, so they'd come together like friends do, but they were going back to their respective villages or whatever, and the pact was that they would continue and deepen their exploration, and if somebody, one or the other, found like a lead or some kind of lead on freedom in general, that they would bring the other one into it. They would let the other one know. So they kind of had each other's back in this spiritual kind of experience, you know, this kind of inquiry. So Moggallana went to his village and got back into his life, and Sariputta was traveling, and at some point he met a Buddhist monk. And he had never seen one before, and the Buddha had just started his teachings and started a community. So he saw this guy who's a kind of a renunciate in robes, I imagine just about the way that you would recognize one now. And so he goes up to this guy, this monk, and he says, what is your deal? Like, I've never seen one of you before. What are you guys practicing? And the monk was sort of, hesitant to really talk about it because he was a novice. And he said, I'm not really supposed to talk about it exactly. I'm really just kind of getting my feet wet here. But Sariputta kind of talked him into it. He's like, look, I'm a smart dude. It's, just give me kind of a hint of what it is that you guys are practicing. He's like, I'm on this quest as well. And, you know, maybe there's something there for me. So the monk goes, okay, let me see if I can kind of sum it up for you. Basically, my teacher teaches that everything has a cause. And my teacher teaches the cause and the end of that cause. Now, Sariputta was in a place of like, that was just like, whoa, I get it. I finally get it. Like that, they say, the story goes that his Dharma eye opened, whatever the hell that means. But his Dharma eye opened, and so this was like a really, he was just prepped for that insight, and it just took him to the next level. So of course, as promised, he goes and he finds this guy, Moggallana, and he tells him, I met this guy, he was a monk, he was a new guy, and he says, this guy Buddha, he teaches that everything has a cause, and this guy teaches the cause and the end of that cause. And Moggallana, oh man, I get that, I get that. So, what they were talking about is what turns out to be the most foundational teaching in Buddhism. And it's the teaching on what could be talked about as causation or causality. It's part of a bigger teaching known as dependent origination, which is a very complicated teaching. But I think it can be understood in kind of a very simple way. One of the ways that I have heard it talked about is to say that causality or causation means that nothing exists independent of the conditions that precede it. I'll say that again. So no thing exists, not an emotion, an emotional experience, not a perceptual experience, not a thought, not a physical thing. Nothing exists that exists, which is not dependent on the existence of some other thing that came before it. Okay? So that whatever it is, its existence is interconnected with some set of causal conditions that are responsible for its existence. Do you get what I'm saying? Cause and effect. Okay? Another way of talking about this is this very simple thing here, which just points out that if B exists dependent upon A, the significance of this is that if A goes away, then B goes away. Okay? Get it? Simple. A lot of words for kind of a simple concept. B exists and is caused by A. Therefore, B is a result. A is the cause. This is the underlying kind of, this is a simplification of the basic underlying principles to almost every teaching that we have in Buddhism. It is how we understand the Four Noble Truths, which is what I want to talk about today. I'll kind of take you through that. It's how we understand the Eightfold Path. It's how we come to understand karma. Karma just being the results of action. So a certain set of actions or conditions, you get to experience the results. It's a cause and effect relationship. If those actions didn't exist, the results wouldn't exist. So then you can begin to get a sense of what it would mean to understand suffering and its cause. And the idea that if its cause doesn't exist, then it would create a cessation in suffering. Okay? How are you doing? Good? Making sense? So, let's talk about suffering. Buddhism has a very narrow focus. I've said this, I guess, a couple times tonight. But it's not concerned with much more than how suffering arises and how it ceases. So it's important then to understand what we mean by suffering. Suffering, I think it's important to draw a distinction between pain and the kind of discomfort that's inherent in life, and suffering that we add on top of it. Okay? So, I want to come out of the box and say that a life without pain is not possible. The suffering that we add, the suffering that ends in a Buddhist practice, is what we add on top of our experience, out of pushing away discomfort, out of clinging to pleasure, while it's changing or leaving, or holding belief systems that actually kind of argue with reality. And in Buddhism, we talk about this as greed, hatred, and delusion, or aversion, clinging, ignorance, perhaps. It all can be contained under this idea of clinging, because basically we're holding on to a kind of a desire, although desire is not the right word, really, but clinging is this kind of idea that we're holding on to an idea about the way we want it to be that is not how it is. Right? So much of Buddhism then becomes about an exploration or an investigation of the laws that govern life, how it works within us, how suffering engenders, all the sort of relationships between all those parts. That's why we sit in meditation, to study the internal experience, so we can see how it works. And we can become liberated from some of our conditionings, the ways that we were told it works, which actually argue with the truth of the way it works, the assumptions we've made about how it works, which argue with the reality of how it all goes down, or the belief systems that we've adopted because they make us feel good, as opposed to actually looking at the truth of life. The Buddha had a sense that if we moved straight into and kind of had a head-on relationship with the actual truth, and we weren't so deluded and we weren't so clinging all the time, that we would experience a lot less suffering. And that in some ways means that we have to encounter the difficulty, the pain. There's a classic kind of list that people who teach Buddhism generally rattle off when they talk about the difference between pain and suffering, or discomfort and suffering, which is to point out that life contains things like your body hurting sometimes. Is there anybody here whose body has never hurt? That we get sick sometimes, or that the illness exists. Anybody here not been sick? That we age. And aging is a truth. That we die. And that actually everyone that we love is subject to the same set of discomforts and difficulties. Right? These are the ground rules. Like, this is how it works. Jack Kornfield once said to me, if you want it to be some other way, then you have to go start your own planet. That's how it is here. And if that doesn't bum you out enough, we don't get everything we want. Anybody got everything they ever wanted? Sometimes we get what we want and we can't hold on to it. Ever been through a breakup? Wanting the conditions for that person to stay, and yet the conditions shift, they are impermanent, and the conditions for that person to be with you in that intimate kind of relationship, connection, goes away. And it's our clinging to the idea that we should have stayed forever, that out of which suffering arises on some level. Which is separate, actually, in my view, from just the grief that I think just comes as part of the package. You know the difference between just feeling hurt and sad and the suffering that we create out of clinging and the mind going crazy and, you know, all of that stuff. Finally, we are often bound to what we don't want. Ever had a job that included other people? Just quite easy to verify that. So suffering is different from that list of things. It's not that if you meditate hard enough, your body will never hurt, or that you will never die, you won't get old, or that you'll get everything you want, and once you get it, you'll be able to hold on to it, and that nothing will ever challenge you. That's not what the practice is saying.
I'm out of here.
Later. I want to back up. We'll come back to this. We're talking about the Four Noble Truths, basically, which, if you don't know, is the truth of suffering, truth of its cause. Did I just say this? The truth of the end of suffering, and the path that leads to the end of suffering. Okay. But I want to back up and say a couple things about this idea of causality, root the conversation, or the lecture, I guess. I think it's important to say that none of this is dogma. None of this is being proposed to you as something to believe. Okay, these are propositions for you to test in the laboratory of your own direct experience. And if it doesn't match what you feel is true and demonstrable, then you should maybe stay open to it or let it go. But you don't adopt it as a belief. Buddhism does not operate in the realm of belief. It's not, you're not being told what to believe. Please don't take it that way. Rather, you have to witness these truths through your meditation practice in the laboratory of your own direct experience. It doesn't happen on an academic level. It doesn't happen in the realm of intellect. You can't remember the models and memorize the lists and all of that and expect that to be transformational. You'll just be a kind of a Buddhist scholar or something, but you won't have any transformation. This has to be directly experienced. So I just wanted to say that. Now, if this concept of causality is so central that it is the groundwork for all of these other major teachings, then it's super important that you find a way to verify that truth in your own direct experience. You can have a kind of faith and understanding, not faith. Faith is a tricky word. It's maybe verified faith. You've verified this through your own direct experience that you can have a confidence that the rest of what's being proposed actually makes sense. Okay? Where causality is concerned, I think in the physical realm, it is fairly easy to verify. You just take, Sunday I used this, the example of this piece of wood, the stage. This stage does not exist independent of the trees and whatever shellac comes from, and paint. The existence of this very thing, dependent upon the existence of trees that preceded it and whatever shellac comes from. The trees themselves exist only dependent upon sun and soil and water and the existence of the parental trees before that dropped the acorns that the birds ate and whatever, transported them around. And you can begin to see just a very direct insight into interdependence just by kind of paying attention to that truth. So stages don't exist independent of trees. Trees don't exist independent of sun and soil and water. We see very easily verification of, as you walk out of here and spend the next few days, look around and do curtains exist? Do windows? Does the earth, does sun and soil and water exist independent of any other core causal factors that allow them to be? Probably you will, I think, arrive at the answer no fairly quickly. This gets a little trickier when we start to move into the conceptual realm or the non-physical realm. Like, what do we do about thoughts? How do we understand thought or emotion? I think actually most of us can understand that there's a causal relationship between what we think and what we feel emotionally. Right? But so many of our emotions begin as thoughts, and then we get a physical manifestation of those thoughts in the body. If you were to think of something disturbing, you'd have the appropriate physical manifestations, physical sensations associated with disturbance or whatever, happiness. A story I like to tell to support this was I was on a month-long retreat. We were 17 hours a day in silence. And I got very interested in this idea of causality, because someone proposed to me, one of the teachers proposed to me that Buddhism has six senses, that along with the standard five, sight and sound and taste and smell and physical sensation, that Buddhism talks about thought as a sense impression on the mind. It's a sensory impression, and the mind being the receiving organ, just like sound hits the eardrum or light hits the retina. And I thought, well, that's weird, because if you ring a bell, we know that the experience, perceptual experience of the phenomenal sound wave that hits your eardrum is dependent or conditioned by someone ringing the bell. And that light, someone flips the switch, light hits it, the sun rises, and that's clear. Someone bakes something, you smell it. But what about thought? What conditions thought then? Who's ringing the thought bell? You know? So I got really interested in the study of this precise moment of, like, where is a thought born? What conditions thinking? And the story I like to tell about that is that at one point I was sitting and there was kind of lights swirling behind my eyes, like, you know, happens sometimes in sitting meditation. And I noticed my mind wanted to make the kind of swirls into shapes, and I noticed the kind of perceptual inclination of the mind to make, like when you look at clouds and you see Barack Obama, you know, it's just like in the clouds. Well, Barack Obama's not in the clouds, it's your mind's sort of perceptual inclination to, well, you could argue Barack Obama's in the clouds, right? It's arguable, I guess. Same thing with thought. I noticed that one of the things that happened with my thought, or my mind kind of was made, one of the swirls into a star. Like for a split second I thought, oh, that's a star. And then off of the star, I thought of Paul Stanley from KISS. This is the papancha, like a conceptual proliferation. And from KISS, I thought of Detroit Rock City, which is the song they always opened with. And then I see some nodding metal folks. And then, so Detroit Rock City made me think of Detroit, which made me think of Michael Moore, which made me think of Bowling for Columbine, which made me think of, you know, the Wall Street movie, and then my days in New York, and then I missed New York, and then I caught it, and I went, whoa, 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 hold on, let me see the causal chain of cause and effect all the way back to a real-time perceptual experience of the swirl of light behind my eyes. And I verified that over and over again, that even my thoughts existed dependent upon conditional factors of real-time sensory experience. That thoughts themselves were not just arising out of nothing, they were conditioned. That was really a really super profound insight to me, and gave me a lot of confidence in the concept of causality or causation, that nothing exists independent of the causes or conditions that precede that experience, that hold that experience up. And if that swirl had not existed, Paul Stanley would not have existed in that moment, and nor Michael Moore. So this takes us back to understanding that what we begin to see is that there's a cause and effect relationship between these things. So suffering exists dependent upon clinging. So now we've already established that suffering is not the same as pain. It's something different. So clinging, what does that mean? A lot of times in Buddhism, you hear it said that that desire is the cause of suffering. And that's wrong. It's a wrong reading of what's actually being said. You could argue on some level that you had the desire for your phone not to ring. You had the wish that that had not happened. And that some of the suffering kind of arose out of identification with that belief, the clinging to that belief, right? if that belief wasn't, could have just been seen, oh, interesting, there's my mind proposing this erroneous concept that my phone should not go off, that the suffering wouldn't have happened. Suffering, I think, always manifests as a loss of ease in the body, in the heart experiences, and in the mind. And mostly, when you think to yourself, when you kind of verify what your direct experience of suffering is, it's usually a collection of bodily sensations that amount to a loss of ease. You feel contracted or vibration or something. There's a loss of ease in the body. And often in the mind, but I think the mind often conditions that loss of ease in the body. So clinging, when we start to notice a loss of ease, then what I do, I walk through my life now, because mostly I can experience a sort of sense of mostly I don't suffer like I used to. And that means that I walk through my life with a pretty even sense of kind of ease in the body and in my emotional experiences, the experiences of the heart. My mind's pretty calm, mostly. And even when it's erratic, I can have a cultivated relationship to it that just lets it be erratic. But the clinging is when a desire arises and we latch onto it, we get hooked by it. Clinging, I want no pain. But the pain is present. So then the suffering on top of it is this sort of resistance to the difficulty that you're sitting with. I want all pleasure. I don't want this pleasure to end. So we go through the whole gallon of ice cream, and then the next, and there's not enough ice cream in the world, actually. I know this from direct experience. So you see just the simple cause and effect relationship between clinging and the arising of suffering. The Four Noble Truths are two propositions of cause and effect. This is an effect, this is a cause. This is an effect, the cessation, the end of suffering. That's an effect. And the cause of the end of suffering is this Eightfold Path. So practice exists in this eight-part system that conditions the end of suffering, or at least a decrease in the experience of suffering in real time. I don't have a lot of time. I don't want to leave out what the Eightfold Path is, because some of you don't know. So I'm just going to briefly. What I do want to say is that the Eightfold Path is made up of three sections. Okay. All right. So, the Eightfold Path. First two sections are the wisdom part of the path. And this means, this is a right view, which is an understanding of causality, understanding of the Eightfold or the Four Noble Truths, and an understanding of karma. Now, right there we can see even the causal relationship between understanding the Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, karma, and causality. So causality becomes a prerequisite or a causal factor for even being able to comprehend the rest of right view, the Four Noble Truths and karma. Right? Also contained under the wisdom is the second piece, which is right intention, which is simply the intention towards renunciation, that is getting rid of things that cause harm, getting rid of things in your life that stand in the way of the development of your meditation practice. So So we set aside, it's an attitude of being willing to set aside what isn't profitable in the path. So renunciation, non-harming, and kindness. That's right intention. To let go, to not cause harm, and to be kind. That's where the metta practices come in that a lot of you are practicing. Sort of sense of well-wishing for yourself and others. Not harming is where the compassion practices come in. Okay. Now the idea is that wisdom, just a cursory understanding of wisdom, creates the motivation for you to practice the ethics of right speech, right action, right livelihood, the precepts, not doing intoxicants, telling the truth, you know, all of that sort of ethical morality stuff, which is not there in the same way that it might be experienced in other traditions. It's not like you do this stuff, you go to hell kind of thing. It's more like if you do this stuff, you create the conditions. It becomes morality and ethics, kindness, paying attention to how you speak with each other, being non-harming in your sexuality, creates the conditions for you to be able to meditate. And meditation is three parts. Understanding, right effort, right concentration, and right mindfulness, which is mostly what we were practicing here tonight. So the proposition is that if you are out harming people, or you're in conflict with a lot of people, or your life is a mess and you're pissed off, that your capacity actually to be able to cultivate concentration and be mindful is, those are not the optimum conditions for you to do this practice. So much of this becomes a causal factor, causal condition for your ability to meditate. And it is meditation itself that creates insight and clarity, and when you get to the heart of what this practice is all about, is being able to see with precision how suffering arises, how the laws that govern life work, so that you can stop living in resistance to them and actually live in a sort of harmony, not causing harm, not creating suffering for yourself, seeing what's actually there, getting rid of these kind of, all of these belief systems and delusional shit that we adopt along the way that causes us so much pain. See? And it is that insight and clarity that then conditions wisdom. And so wisdom exists as a preliminary factor. It's the thing that motivates you to do the practice. You kind of get a sense that causality makes sense, that the Four Noble Truths might make some sense. And then you do the practices, and then you create the insight and the wisdom through meditation. And you, because of that, you have a deeper sense of wisdom, and you don't suffer so much. That's a very general kind of presentation of it. But I wanted to give you this because this has been so helpful to me, to see that see the ways that each of these elements becomes a causal factor for the other. That ethics conditions our capacity for meditation. That meditation conditions wisdom. That wisdom conditions the motivation for deeper practice. That, back to this model, this Four Noble Truths model, that suffering exists dependent upon clinging. That the cessation of suffering, the end of suffering, a decrease in suffering, can exist dependent upon working this Eightfold Path of right view, right intention, ethics, concentration, meditation. That's why we're doing this. All leading to this very narrow focus, all in service of this narrow focus of the end of suffering. So we can see why the Buddha began his first teaching on suffering and how it works. As you were saying, suffering is the core of the whole, it's the only concern. How does suffering arise? We're asked to understand This is all action-oriented, by the way. We're asked to understand, let go, experience, cultivate. Not intellectual, it's not academic, it's doing. And that's why that statue looks so damn happy. He did all that shit. But it's concerned with suffering. How are we doing? Did I do it? Did we make it? Any questions? I have time maybe for a couple.
One thing, if you could just touch on how all of that informs the concept of not self, or no self. Because I think we didn't get to that yet. If we could just touch on it a little bit.
Basically, what's being proposed in the teachings on not self, as I understand them. So what the Buddha tried to do is he gave a teaching on the aggregates. The ways that we build a sense of self and cling to it in the face of impermanence. I mean, one of the key teachings of Buddhism is that nothing stays the way that it is. So if we, for example, are identified with the aggregate of our bodies, well, have you looked at a picture of yourself as a child lately? Is that who you are? You are this body? I mean, every 7 years, I guess every cell in this body turns over. It's not, the way that it's often presented, it makes it sound like we aren't a self. And it's not really, I think, a very useful way of presenting it. What's useful is not getting attached to a solid, static sense of self while things are all changing, while change is the name of the game. If we cling to this body staying the same way, with our, keeping all of our hair and not growing around the midsection and not no wrinkles and all that, so you can see the arising of suffering out of a clinging to an idea about the way your body should be or behave. We all experience that, especially in this culture. It's a very obvious kind of example.
It's not that there's no self, it's that there's no permanent,
right,
ever cast in stone self.
Right.
Because everything is always shifting and changing.
That there's no part of us that should be clinged to. Even in Buddhism, even our consciousness. Because if they're saying if we don't want to identify with our thoughts, our mental formations, we don't want to identify with this body, we don't want to identify with our perceptual experiences, we don't even want to identify with consciousness itself. Some of the Hindu traditions will kind of, that's an arguing point, okay, so then I am that knows, that witnesses. But the Buddha's argument there was actually, even consciousness itself arises only in dependence on phenomenal experience. If there's nothing to be conscious of, then consciousness doesn't exist. So don't cling to consciousness. Don't cling to this body. Don't cling to your views and opinions. Don't cling to the perceptual experiences of concepts. None of that is, it's all conditioned. That your freedom exists in allowing the kind of flow and impermanence to just reign. And the more that you're identified, the more that you're clinging, the more you will suffer. That's the best that I've gotten. Yeah?
Is there a difference between the mind and thoughts? Are there any stories that kind of help people understand this concept of self or non-self better?
I don't know if there are any stories. I can tell you that the vocabulary that I would use in the first part of your question is that there is definitely a difference between thought and awareness of the thought. And that's what we practice here, right? It's like, I practice moving directing your consciousness to different parts of the phenomenal experiences, right? I started with the breath, which means that our awareness can focus on the breath, leaving thoughts in the background, leaving sounds in the background, leaving other physical sensations in the background, that we can concentrate on that. And what happens, and the reason we do that, we choose a physical sensation, is that we begin to have some insight on our addiction to identification with thought all the time. It breaks that identity, that identification. So you get some space around your thinking. But consciousness is something different than the contact of your feet on the floor. You can bring your consciousness there. You can bring your consciousness to the awareness of my voice, the sound waves hitting your eardrums. That's not who you are. You're not the contact of your feet on the floor. You're not your thoughts. Thoughts are processes, conditioned processes arising out of real-time physical sensation, conditioned by phenomena. If you had different phenomena, you'd have different thoughts. You know, it's not who you are. And the more we stay identified, the more we suffer. I like that too. We're out of time. Any announcements? To offer the merit of what we do. It's traditional to offer the merit of any of these gatherings. May any goodness of this gathering, this communication, our practice, not just benefit ourselves, but be of benefit to all of those that we encounter on our life's path. This is not just for us, it's for everybody. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.